Micah chapter 7, we begin with verse 1. Woe is me, for I am as when they have gathered the summer fruits, as the grape gleanings of the vintage. There is no cluster to eat. My soul desired the first ripe fruit. The good man is perished out of the earth, and there is none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net, that they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asketh, and the judge asketh for a reward. And the great man, he uttereth his mischievous desire. So they wrap it up. The best of them is as a briar. The most upright is sharper than a thorn hedge. The day of thy watchman and thy visitation cometh. Now shall be their perplexity. Trust ye not in a friend? Put ye not confidence in a guide? Keep the doors of thy mouth from her that lieth in thy bosom. For the son dishonoreth the father, the daughter riseth up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own house. Therefore I will look unto the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy. When I fall, I shall arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord, because I have sinned against him, until he plead my cause and execute judgment for me. He will bring me forth to the light, and I shall behold his righteousness. Then she that is mine enemy shall see it, and shame shall cover her which said unto me, Where is the Lord thy God? Mine eyes shall behold her. Now shall she be trodden down as the mire of the streets. Amen. We'll end our reading in verse 10, knowing that the Lord will add his blessing to this reading from his word for his name's sake. I want to call your attention in particular to verses 8 and 9, where the prophet says, Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy. When I fall, I shall arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him, until he plead my cause and execute judgment for me. He will bring me forth to the light, and I shall behold his righteousness. In verse 8, we have that phrase, that statement, When I fall, I shall arise. When I fall, I shall arise. This chapter in the book of Micah demonstrates to us the pervasive effects of sin. The good man is perished out of the earth, and there is none upright among men, the prophet complains in verse 2. Sin had permeated the entire nation, making a good man so rare as to be practically non-existent. The prince, in verse 3, as well as the judge, asketh for a reward, it says. In other words, they could be bribed. And wanted to be. So pervasive was this corruption that the prophet says in verse 5, Trust not in a friend, put not confidence in a guide. Where sin abounds, you see, trust can't exist. You can't trust anyone. If I was an economics major, I would love to do research and write a paper on how trust is the bottom line criterion for an economy to be able to function, and where trust fails, so will the nation's economy eventually fail. But the prophet goes even further in this chapter and shows how the pervasive effects of sin made its way into households and affected families. So we read in verse 6, "For the son dishonoreth the father, the daughter riseth up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own house." And at last the prophet must boil the whole matter down to an individual level and admit that he too is no exception to this trend. He too has not been unaffected by the sin all around him. So we read his confession in verse 9, "I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him." Verses 8 and 9 show us three spiritual realities that pertain to the Christian. The first reality is the one I've just mentioned, and that is that the Christian falls. The second spiritual reality is that the Christian has a spiritual enemy who rejoices in his fall. "Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy," Micah says in verse 8. And who would deny that the devil's greatest delight comes in the fall of the Lord's people? That's something we would do well to keep in mind and hopefully utilize as a force of restraint against our own sins. The knowledge that when we sin, we bring great joy and delight to the devil. But the third and perhaps the most important spiritual reality found in these verses is the reality that when the Christian falls, he also rises. When he goes through a period of darkness, he eventually sees the light of the Lord again. And so again in verse 8 we read, "When I fall, I shall arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me." There is no such thing, you see, as a Christian who falls and remains fallen. There's no such thing as a Christian who experiences darkness and remains in darkness. And the reason a Christian cannot remain in a darkened and fallen state is twofold. The Lord simply will not allow it. "The Lord will plead my cause," is the implication of the words in verse 9. "And he will execute judgment for me," verse 9. "And he will bring me forth to the light," verse 9. The Lord being the subject of every one of those statements. If I could then summarize these spiritual realities that are revealed in this text and express that summary as a theme for our study this morning in preparation for the Lord's table, I would express that summary or my theme this way. In Micah chapter 7, verses 8 and 9, we find revealed the fallen Christian's recovery. The fallen Christian's recovery. And that's what I want to think about this morning and invite you to think with me. The fallen Christian's recovery. Would you think with me, first of all, on the inevitability of the Christian's fall? Sad but true, it is inevitable. "When I fall," Micah says in verse 8. He's either making reference to his present experience or he's speaking in terms of what he can surely anticipate. In either case, the inevitability of falling is plainly set before us. Notice that he says, "When I fall," not "if I fall." In a fallen world and in a corrupted society, the Christian, sadly, will fall. His love will grow cold. The world will allure him. And the world will find a ready ally in his flesh. Add to this fact that he faces a spiritual enemy in the devil who is devoted to his fall, who stalks the world as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Even as Christians, we have fallen, we do fall. And unfortunately, we will fall. So we might as well be clothed enough in humility to acknowledge the truth rather than cater to pride or self-deception, which will deny such a thing. Contrary to the notions of some who are either self-deceived or puffed up in pride, there is no such thing as perfection in our current state. Paul writes in Galatians 5 and verse 17 that the flesh lusteth against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. And in Romans 7, we find Paul describing Christian experience when he writes in verse 15, "For that which I do, I allow not, for what I would, that do I not, but what I hate, that do I." Oh, I tell you what, if there is one area in which I can identify with Paul, it is in that chapter of Romans 7. Now, you may take it to be evidence of grace in your life that you have the very desire to pursue the things that are pleasing to God and are in keeping with holiness. But we're still gripped by a tension within us between the spirit and the flesh, which leads us to an inability to do the things that we would. We like to think, don't we, at times that we're making progress in our sanctification. And there are certainly times by the Lord's grace that we do gain victory over the world and the flesh and the devil. And in those times, we enjoy close communion with our Savior. But as often as not, we find ourselves having to acknowledge that all we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned each one to his own way. And in our turning to our own way, we lose our joy, we lose our peace, we lose our strength and our spiritual vitality. Think about it for a moment. How many of the great men in the Bible avoided falling? I love the fact that our Bibles record for us the great deeds and the tremendous exploits of the characters of the Bible, but I love it even more that the Bible also reveals their sins. I'm glad I can read of Abraham trying to manipulate the promises of God that were given to him, that we find him and his wife thinking they have to take matters into their own hands by Sarah giving her handmaid to Abraham in order to have children by her. I'm glad that's revealed, because that kind of fallen reasoning is something I can relate to at times. And I'm glad to read of the exploits of David, but I'm also glad that God did not spare the revelation of David's sins. He was a man after God's own heart who nevertheless fell into sin, into very serious sin. You and I could never aspire to be like David if we only have the accounts of his victory over Goliath or his many victories over the Philistines. David was a man who also knew what it was to fall and to abide in a condition of darkness that at one point in his life lasted even for years. Think of that time when he fled from Israel and took refuge in the city of Ziklag that was assigned to him by the Philistine ruler. So discouraged did he become, so sure was he that Saul would eventually apprehend him and execute him, that he fell, and he fell into darkness, and he stayed in that condition of darkness for, it was at least 18 months, more than a year. I'm glad we have the account of Peter walking on the water, but that the account includes how he sank. I'm glad we have the accounts of the disciples arguing over who would be the greatest, and we have the account of their inability to watch with Christ in prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. And we have the account of their boastings, which proved to be empty boasts when they all forsook the Lord. I'm glad we have the accounts of Peter's denials of Christ. How else could I hope for restoration following my own practical denials apart from such accounts as these? These are the things you see that brings the Bible to our level. And I love that. I love that the Bible is brought to my level. These are the things that enable us to relate to what's written. This is why I can confess that the Bible, or that God through the Bible, reaches me where I really am. It doesn't simply place before me an impossible ideal. Now, in a sense, it does do that, because it does reveal that God's standards are very high standards. But if that's all the Bible did, then it wouldn't be a book that I would have much interest in. Why would I bother spending time in a book that only magnified my sins and my failures? So facing the inevitability of our many falls enables us to prepare for those falls. We learn to see into them, and we learn to look beyond them. We find instruction as to what we must do in those falls. The worst thing in the world for a Christian to do is to deny those falls or ignore those falls. So John writes in his first epistle, chapter 1 and verse 8, "If we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us." That kind of self-deception is what will keep the Christian from recovering, or at the very least, it will unnecessarily delay his recovery. So we see the inevitability of the Christian's falls. When I fall, Micah says, the inevitability of such falls becomes all the more plain when we consider, in the second place, the cause and condition of the Christian's fall. The cause is very simple. It must be faced. Listen to what it says in verse 9. "I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against Him," the prophet says. Our falls are inevitable because there abides in every Christian still an old and carnal nature. So in Romans chapter 7 and verse 14, Paul writes, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin." 2 verses later, he goes on to say, "If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me." He says it again in verse 20, "Sin dwelleth in me." And then he says the same thing again in the next verse, but in slightly different terms, when he writes, "I find then a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me." And so you pile these things up. "Sin dwells in me," verse 16. "Sin dwells in me," verse 20. "I find a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me," verse 21. And when this happens, our spiritual condition becomes one of darkness. "I sit in the darkness," the prophet says back in Micah chapter 7 and verse 8. And what does that darkness amount to but a loss of spiritual vision? He's not seeing Christ. He's not seeing the God that he loves. He may be seeing the world around him. He's seeing what the carnal eye sees. But he, spiritually speaking, is sitting in the darkness. A Christian in this condition, you see, as I say, no longer sees Christ. You no longer enjoy Christ. Your religion, what little there may be of it, becomes forced. You leave off time in prayer and time in the Word. You still may go to church because that's something that's expected of you. You might not leave off doing that too were it not for the fact, or you might leave off doing that too were it not for the fact that if you left off doing that, others would take notice and someone out of concern for you might actually deal with you and call you to account. So you continue in church, but if you're honest, you have to say you have no heart for it. It's a forced compliance. Some grown-ups view it the same way young and immature Christians view it. It's something you have to do, but not something you want to do. And when you're in darkness and you're not meeting with Christ, the thing that you notice more than anything else may be the faults of others. The things that you take to be wrong with the church and wrong with the preacher and wrong with other families in the church. And would you notice from the text that the Christian is planted in darkness, as it were? It's not something that he quickly goes through, but rather it says he sits in darkness. When you sit somewhere, you're planted, so to speak. You're going to be there for a while. Verse 9 shows us very clearly that the Lord is not indifferent to Christians in such a condition. Notice what it says, "I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him." Now we need to understand that the prophet is not now speaking of the wrath of the Lord that springs from the principle of judgment. It is rather the fatherly displeasure of the Lord that springs from fatherly concern. Fathers and mothers, we know this, don't we? They get angry with their children. They don't stop loving their children, but they do get angry with them. And their anger springs from their love. Listen to the opening verses of Psalm 85. In fact, why don't I have you turn to that psalm? Psalm 85, if you would. Here we go. These verses will show you what I mean by a fatherly displeasure. Listen to the words of the psalmist. "Now, Lord, thou hast been favorable unto thy land. Thou hast brought back the captivity of Jacob. Thou hast forgiven the iniquity of thy people. Thou hast covered all their sin, Selah. Thou hast taken away all thy wrath. Thou hast turned thyself from the fierceness of thine anger. Turn us, O God of our salvation, and cause thine anger toward us to cease. Wilt thou be angry with us forever? Wilt thou draw out thine anger to all generations? Wilt thou not revive us again that thy people may rejoice in thee?" You see what I mean here? Thou hast taken away all thy wrath. Thou hast turned thyself from the fierceness of thine anger. Verse 3. That's propitiation. That's the fire of judgment being spent on the sacrifice instead of on the person. But then there follows in verse 5 the question, "Wilt thou be angry with us forever? Wilt thou draw out thine anger to all generations?" Here is that fatherly displeasure, which in the psalmist's view seems to go on and on and on indefinitely. This is the indignation of the Lord that is referred to back in Micah chapter 7 and verse 9. And so the condition of the Christian in his fallen condition is now plainly set before us. And if we're honest with ourselves, I think we have to acknowledge that we know all too well what Micah is talking about. And the fact that the Christian's falls are inevitable, and that he needs many times to be turned back to the Lord, convinces me this morning that there are those here this morning under the sound of my voice that are sitting in the darkness, and you've lost the joy of salvation. You've lost any sense of peace or joy or spiritual vitality. You know what those things are. You can recall times in the past when you've known such things, but they seem to be things of the past and are rarely, if ever, things of the present. The fact that there would be Christians here this morning in this kind of condition is not really a surprising thing. But what I do get concerned about is when a Christian comes to accept this condition as the norm of his experience. In other words, all you know and all you've come to ever expect is that your religion is and will ever be nothing more than a source of guilt or bondage or deadness. Something that you force yourself to externally comply with. Oh, dear believer in Christ, you should not accept that. You should not allow yourself to come to such a settled, pessimistic outlook about your walk with the Lord. The prophet sets a better example for us than that. And this is what leads to my final point of analysis about the fallen Christian's recovery. Would you note with me, thirdly and finally, the aim and action of faith in the Christian's fall? The aim and action of faith in the Christian's fall. I've been up to this point placing a strong emphasis on the inevitability of the Christian's fall. I'm now ready to assert that there is a certain and equal inevitability to the Christian's recovery. When I fall, I shall arise, verse 8. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. Would you notice with me that while the prophet acknowledges the inevitability of his fall, he does not accept that it's final. He does not suggest that his fall leads to a new norm where all he knows and all he ever expects to know is spiritual darkness and the indignation of the Lord. He knows that the light of Christ will break through at last. There may be, and indeed there is, a period of indignation to bear, but he knows that this indignation of the Lord is not the end. This is what faith must affirm. When I fall, I shall arise, and when I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. And for those of you that find yourselves sitting in the darkness this morning, bearing the Lord's indignation, you need to confess that you will bear that indignation, especially since you've sinned against Christ. But you should also affirm that you will arise and you will see the light of Christ's love and grace and favor again. Don't accept the darkness, therefore. Don't resign yourself to a permanent loss of joy and peace and spiritual vitality. But anticipate, rather, that you will arise and that the Lord's indignation will, in the end, bring forth the peaceable fruit of righteousness in your life. Now, there is good grounds in our text for affirming this to be the case. Notice again in verse 9 these words, I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him. And then underscore this next statement, until he plead my cause and execute judgment for me. We have the advantage in our day of being on the other side of the cross than the prophet found himself. Micah looked forward to the cross of Christ. You and I are able to look back on the cross of Christ. And we are enabled to affirm today that Christ does plead our cause. Pleading our cause, you see, amounts to the intercession of Christ for you and for me. And so we read in Romans 8 and verse 34, who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us. Pleading our cause, making intercession for us. And what's more, his intercession is grounded in the execution of his judgment. Notice from Micah 7 and verse 9 that the prophet says that the Lord would plead his cause and execute judgment for me. It doesn't say that he would execute judgment upon him, but for him. And this is what Christ has done by his atoning death. He has executed our judgment. He has borne the wrath that his Father's justice demanded. And so it follows, he has purchased you to himself. He has loved you with an everlasting love. He has brought you into his family. He has reconciled you to himself. He has redeemed your soul from hell and will therefore never forget you and never forsake you. These are the things that the elements of the Lord's table preach to us this morning. Let the bread and the cup say to you, Christ pleads my cause and has executed judgment for me. And in the confidence of the cross, and this is very important, it must be the confidence of the cross, not in the confidence of your own weak and flimsy resolve, but in the confidence of the cross, affirm today, dear believer, that when you fall, you shall arise, and when you sit in the darkness, the light of Christ's love will break into your heart again, and you will regain a lost joy and a lost vitality. Your heart will know again the blessed reality of Christ's love for you and Christ's concern for you and Christ's interest for the things that are very dear and near on your heart. So let's set the matter straight this morning before we approach the Lord's table. Your loss of joy and peace and vitality is traceable to your own sin. A part of this sacrament observance this morning is the acknowledgement of just that. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against Him. Your darkness is due to your sin. The Lord hasn't done you wrong. The Lord does all things well. But our darkness comes from our sin. But Christ pleads your cause. And Christ has executed your judgment. You mean too much to Him, therefore, for Him to leave you in the darkness and leave you in a fallen condition. If you belong to Him, if you believe in Him, if you have any affection toward Him because you know in some measure the exceeding greatness of His affection toward you, then you can fully expect that when you fall, you will arise, and when you sit in darkness, His light will break in upon your heart at last. May this time around His table serve to bring that light to souls that have sat too long in darkness, and may it serve to bring us all to a renewed sense of His love and His grace and His mercy. Let's close in prayer then before we distribute the elements.